Hi, this is Mario Andretti, and you need more front wing.
Hello and welcome to the second podcast of the Eyes on IndyCar Series season from More Front Wing. I'm Steph Walcraft, joined as always by Paul Dalby. And this week, filling the third chair for us, all the way from Australia, the international superstar Shane Rogers. Shane, thanks for joining us this week.
Thanks, Steph. Good to be here.
Always good to have you on. So, do you think we have a little bit to talk about St. Pete? Quite a few things came up. I think that unquestionably the topic of the weekend was whether the changes to the restart rules were of value and whether we should continue to use them moving forward. Of course, there was the rather enormous wreck at the very start of the race, which ended up seeing Marco on his head for the second season in a row in the opener, and also saw Elio, Ryan Briscoe, and Scott Dixon end up several laps down before being able to continue on and essentially taking them out of the fight for the lead very early in the race. For my money, first of all, the complaints about double wide being the cause of all of these issues, really, that aspect of it doesn't hold any water because, as has been discussed at length in the media, the largest wreck was the one at the start, and that was going to happen anyway. I mean, you put a bunch of go-getters on the track, and it's been 6 months since the last time they raced. This seems to happen all the time. I don't really think that there's any benefit in placing any blame there. And it did take a little while. I think it was four cautions in quick succession before things really got going in the race, but things eventually did get going. For my part, I think that as much as the drivers were complaining that they didn't like it, they kind of had better get used to it because it certainly did make for more interesting viewing. And not only at St. Pete, but at some of the other tracks going forward, thinking ahead in the year to the ones where the racing has been so stunted in past years. I'm thinking of Barber, Mid-Ohio, those kinds of tracks. I could really see this being a benefit. St. Pete, a bit... Turn one is a little bit hairy, and so maybe that could have contributed to some of the issues here. But also, the drivers just have to accept and learn to adapt to the fact that this is the way that things are going to be going forward. They just can't continue on with the attitude that they all had, just piling all in at the start. They're going to have to learn how to adapt and how to adjust their driving styles for the new rules. For me, I don't think anything needs to change. I think that while Ryan Hunter-Reay made a good point that technically these cars need a little bit more speed and a little bit more braking room, I still think that this is a skilled professional field for the most part, and they should be able to handle the challenge accordingly. What do you guys think? Shane, you're the guest. Why don't you chime in next?
Look, I think with a restart and start situation like that, when you've got something new, you've got to give it a go. And I think, you know, IndyCar deserve credit for giving it a go. Some things work and some things don't. I think the issue for me is the double-file restarts, per se, probably didn't go too badly. The double file, the first double file start was pretty terrible, but the question is it a first go thing? Is it they haven't got the procedure right? It's probably hard to tell until you give it another go. So you've probably got to give it the benefit of the doubt for now. But I think the concerns for me were when you restart that close to the start finish line, there were some people in the sort of the row 5 to row 8 range on all the restarts that had some momentum when the green flag dropped. And I think you've got to be very careful when you don't have everyone going the same speed or when you have the people at the back going faster than the people at the front. That's when you get big accidents that starts happening. And I can think of, you know, even back to the old days of Formula One Grand Prix racing, and you had the accident where Ronnie Peterson lost his life. I think it was 79-10 Grand Prix, don't quote me. But in that race, you know, the cause of that accident, in a lot of ways, was the fact that when the green light turned on, the front row was stopped, but the rear rows were still moving, and the rear rows caught the front rows and caused the accident. And I think there was a little bit of that in some of the accidents that I saw. I think,
but is that still not just a matter of the drivers getting used to the way that the restarts are going to happen and not building up that momentum at the back of the field? I mean, that seems to me to be something that they can control.
I think you've got no choice, because I think they were told to catch up as quickly as possible. But the problem is the leaders got to the line before they had the opportunity to do so. So some of them had momentum. It would be my preference if they started a little bit further back on the start. I think the restarts are a different kettle of fish. My view on the restarts is you should start single file. The benefit of single file is it gives you another lane to pass. And I think what we'll find is when we get to places like Barber and Mid-Ohio and the like, I think what will happen is we'll all come barreling too wide into the corner, which is great, but there's no opportunity to pass because we're already too wide. There's no passing lane. I think you'd be better off on some of those circuits to actually have a single file restart with the bunching, providing the back cars aren't going at a supersonic speed compared to the front cars.
But I see what you're saying, but at those tracks, there was no passing really happening anyway. I don't know that having a second line open is going to improve that.
I think the no passing at those tracks is probably more because they're restarting at the wrong spot. My view is here, and I've probably been pretty adamant about it from the start, and I saw nothing that really changed my mind on the weekend, and that was we've made two changes here, and they're two very different changes, and they are the double file start and the positioning and of where we drop the green flag, and it would have been my preference to do one or the other and not both. Now, the reason for that is if this doesn't work, and jury might be still be out, if it doesn't work, you don't know which one to change, and so rather than building up to the right answer, you sort of got to slide back. And I would still prefer a normal start back to what we've sort of had, with maybe the exception of Indianapolis, but the restarts I would prefer single file.
Interesting. Paul?
Well, I think Shane just hit it right on the head, and it was exactly what I was going to say, is that, you know, we've implemented two major changes here. We've thrown two things at the wall. Something didn't work at St. Pete, and now we don't know which one it is. Is it the double file restarts? Is it the later restart? My personal opinion is that it's the later restart, and Shane started going here before he went a different direction. But if you saw the overhead view shots from the restarts of this race, what you saw was, again, what I have complained about at the start of the race happen every time we start it, is that they don't line the cars up until way, way, way late. They weren't lining the cars up until they were coming through turn 13 or 14. Well, okay, they come through turn 13 or 14. All of a sudden, you have the first, you know, what, three, four, five rows that get lined up two by two, and all of a sudden they hit their brakes, basically, to get down to 70 miles an hour. And as Shane alluded to, you have the guys that are in, you know, positions 10 and back who are full on their throttle trying to get into 2x2 alignment. By the time they get there, the green flag's out, and they just keep gunning it. So you have the guys at the front of the field, the first three or four rows that are sitting at 70 miles an hour. You've got the guys at the back of the field that are coming at 100, 110 miles an hour. What do you think they're going to do? Of course they're going to take that opportunity to go flying by, and you run into the situation that we had I think it was Simona was probably starting fourth or something like that, and Justin went to pass her, and she went to pass someone else. All of a sudden you end up four wide going into turn one, and Justin's running through the grass because, you know, at that point he's committed to the move. I mean, he tried to get out of it, but it was just too late by the time they're four wide. So which is it? Is it the double file restart or is it the late start?
There's a third factor in there that you're not taking into consideration, and that's the fact that the drivers should be able to handle this. Drivers.
And I agree. But again, this is the first like you said, it's the first race in 6 months. They're anxious. They want to get out there. B, they've spent their whole careers with this more traditional type of restart. You're not going to reprogram the driver mentality in the first restart of a race of this procedure. It's going to take time, and yes, they are.
Right, and that's I guess what I really was getting at, is that they should stick with it.
Right.
And give a few more shots, give the drivers a bit more of a chance to get into the rhythm and see what it's going to take from them to not hit each other every time they make a shot at this, and then see how things are going.
I agree. I think you need to stick with it, and let's not throw it out just because we had some problems. And like Shane said, and like Dario said in the post-race conference on Sunday, the biggest problem was really at the start of the race where you were having the traditional two-wide start anyway. Really, the only time we had a problem with the double-wide restart was, again, the one I alluded to with Simona and Justin running side-by-side and making it four-wide. I think it gets back to the point, though, and I think the problem, again, is that we've lined up too late and the field is still in the middle of that accordion effect, and it hasn't, there's a damper effect, and it hasn't stabilized by the time the green flag comes out. You need to get the field lined up. If you're going to do this, you need to get the field lined up two by two so that they have more than enough time to get into that formation and come to a stabilized speed throughout the entire field when the green flag is displayed. You don't want part of the field at one speed and the rear part at a faster speed still trying to catch up. That's where the recipe for disaster comes, because all of a sudden those guys, like you said, back in rows 5 or 6, they think this is the perfect time to make a bonsai move, and they think that they can make, there are limited opportunities to pass, whether you have two wide restarts or not. There are limited times to pass, especially on a street course. And when we get to a place like Barber or Mid-Ohio, where it's very narrow motorcycle tracks, basically.
Maybe, sorry to interrupt, maybe what needs to happen, though, is race control needs to be taking a look at these guys making these bonsai moves and considering whether that might be avoidable contact.
It could be avoidable contact, but if there's a solution, if there's a relatively simple solution, such as getting the cars aligned earlier before the start-finish line, then I think some of that avoidable contact in those, and the drivers get a little less brave, and those opportunities aren't quite as open door as they appeared to be at St. Pete this last weekend.
Yeah. Look, there's no doubt in my mind you've got to give it another go, having committed to it. The challenge will be at Barber. The run's not exactly a huge run before the start-finish either.
Exactly.
So that's going to be more of a problem.
Is it at Long Beach, to be fair.
No.
It's not particularly long. You're coming out of that hairpin at Long Beach.
Having said that, on the other hand, at Barber, you haven't got a track that's got four grooves either. So you might find you get some cleaner starts at Barber rather than the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think you've got to give it another go. I think there's procedurally some things you could do. I think it was probably disappointing from a let's see how well it worked point of view to not have a late race restart. I think it'd be interesting to see how that would go
mm-hmm.
when there's a bit more, more marbles on the track and debris and all that sort of stuff that can influence a double file restart. Because one of the motivations for not lining up two by two really early in the lap would be to avoid the marbles. So mm-hmm. I think, you've got to give it another go. We'll see how it goes after that. I think, on the other hand, if you look at something that doesn't deserve to be given another go, I think the qualifying tyre rules were a disaster and took all the sucked all the interest away out of the event, and they should get rid of that as quickly as they can.
Oh, absolutely.
I would agree.
Cars sitting on jacks does not make for an exciting qualifying session. That was quite terrible. And, something else to toss in here, though, is that for some reason, the red tyres this weekend were just, frankly, too good. They lasted too long. They didn't wear the way that they're supposed to, and people were just able to stay on them. There were a bunch of cars that used them for all three qualifying segments, weren't there?
Well, yeah. Will Power went out in the Firestone Fast 6, the third session, and set the fastest time of all the qualifying sessions on his second stint with those red tires. He was 2/10 faster in the third session than he was on the same pair of tires when they were new. In the second section.
Yeah, the reds aren't supposed to do that. And that would be a big part of what the problem was with that. There's no way that they need 10 minutes for the Firestone Fast 6 if people are going to be sitting on the jacks for 5 of those minutes waiting to see what everybody else is going to do.
Exactly.
I think it's one of those things with that rule as it is. It doesn't give people like Justin Wilson the opportunity to have the potential to take the risk to get to the last session on a new set of reds, and that's disappointing. It takes out the exact thing that someone like Randy Bernard wants to demonstrate, and that is that, you know, we have drivers that are very good and that are better than other drivers.
Right. So, yeah, I would be surprised if that lasted very much longer. In fact, I think I said on Twitter at the time that I'd be kind of surprised if it wasn't changed for Barber, because, frankly, it was kind of dull. And that's the exact opposite of what they were thinking was going to happen with it. I see what they were getting at, but it completely didn't work the way that they expected. So, absolutely, I think we all agree on that.
And another point about the red tires and that they were just too darn good. Look what Simona was able to do on those red tires at the end of the race. I mean, she was on those tires for 25, 30 laps, probably, somewhere in that ballpark.
She held them quite nicely, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they held up.
And it was blistering hot out that day, too.
Well, not quite blistering hot. I mean, if it was 3 months later, it would have felt, you know, okay. But, yeah, it was low 80s,
okay.
I would guess.
People were complaining that it was very hot on Twitter. My bad.
That's because you may have had a few Midwesterners who are not quite in.
that's about an average day down here at this time.
But yeah, there was a race last year where everyone just praised Firestone because they made this great red
Sonoma.
Was it Sonoma?
Yeah.
They made this great red tire
because
that
the tire
was
actually went off.
Yes, and it was blistering fast at the beginning, and then you got, you know, 6, 7, 8, 10 laps out, and all of a sudden you could see it start to fall off, and the black tire just stayed steady and stable the whole run.
Which is supposed to be the whole point of the primary versus alternate system.
Exactly.
I can see Firestone's position of not wanting to have a tire that looks like it's underperforming on television. But on the other hand, that's the whole interest of this whole thing. And it's supposed to add a little bit of disparity to road and street racing. And that's exactly what did not happen this weekend. So.
And when Firestone created those red tires that fell off at Sonoma last year, they were praised across the board. They
absolutely.
They weren't derided for making a bad tire. The drivers and the owners never came out and said, I couldn't go fast because my tires fell apart. No, they were praised across the board for doing what they needed to do. And I don't know, maybe they just missed it this time. You know,
it's interesting you compare and contrast this weekend in St. Pete with what happened just down the road here at Albert Park for the Australian Formula One Grand Prix, and Pirelli first Formula One race since I think 1991 for them, and they've come with they come here with a lot of PR baggage coming into the first race. They got universally caned in the you know, pre-testing media reports regarding the life of the tyre, and they came to Albert Park, and the end conclusion was some cars did one stop, some cars did two, and some cars did three, and universally they've come out smelling like roses.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Pirelli had big shoes to fill anyway, though. There was no way that they weren't going to be criticised up and down.
I think they did a superb job. I think they did, I think, you know, when you consider the amount of time they had to turn it around and the result they got it in Melbourne. Now, whether that'll translate to Malaysia, where you've got a completely different climate, is another question. But we'll see how we go. So far, they've you know, top marks.
But it does bring up the point for us to once again thank Firestone for staying on with the series, because that sort of uncertainty is not something that you want to be dealing with when you're rolling out a new car in 2012. So.
Mm-hmm.
So no, thank you, Firestone.
Yeah, and it was the right move for IndyCar to not choose a risk strategy there, given they've got a risk strategy with the new car. There's so many unknowns they'll have to contain, and Tony Cotman and group will have to fix. So now is the time not to be adding more risk.
And based on my memory, and I don't want to call anybody out here, but To my mind, Firestone has, for open wheel racing in America, had by far the most reliable tire performance. I don't recall from back in the tire wars. I don't I mean, Firestone wasn't always the primary tire used by the majority of the teams, but I recall it being the most stable over the passage of time.
Yeah, and Al Spire and Joe Barbieri, they make that point anytime they can, is that since they returned to open-wheel racing in 1995, or at least to top-level open-wheel racing in 1995, they haven't had a single tire failure that's led to a crash. That's in what, 203 or 4 IndyCar races now, and however many Champ Car races that, you know, Bridgestone / Firestone contributed from 96 all the way through 2008. So, I mean, they have an absolutely impeccable record of safety, and absolutely they deserve kudos for not only the safety, but, you know, they were able to maintain safety and speed, and they just mopped the floor with Goodyear. And they mopped the floor with them without sacrificing that safety.
Well, moving on, let's talk about TK and Simona. That was quite the story this weekend as well. TK, of course, having a heck of a drive just to keep Simona behind him with his first weekend with KV Racing. I think he mentioned 6 days on the job he was, didn't even know the names of all of his team members yet, was just starting to get to know Michael Cannon, who, oddly enough, had joined KV from HVM that very week, which, of course, left Simona with just getting to know her engineer that weekend as well, and driving that car to a fourth-place finish very nearly points, taking third place away from TK. What a drive for both of them. Comments, either of you?
Well, what can you say about the new intern at KV Racing? He's still got it. He's still got it. I mean, obviously they benefit with a bit of luck from the crowding in the midfield. I mean, you know, we lost Briscoe, we lost Conway, we lost Castro Neves. You know,
this brings up a really good point. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Shane. I am so tired of people saying, oh, Simona only got fourth or TK only got third because they didn't get caught up in that melee at the beginning of the race. They got those positions because they didn't get caught up in that, and that is a credit to them, not some kind of, you know, reason why the finish was a write-off. It's their smart driving that got them those positions, not the fact that they didn't get caught up in the crash. I just want to make that point.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. The key with Canaan especially, you could tell that car wasn't the most superbly handling car in the world at points during that race, but he, you know, was smart and didn't do anything stupid to throw it away, and that's experience. What impressed me more is Simona did the same thing. I mean, Simona probably, you know, had the car to have a crack at Tony and try and get that position, but the reality is, you know, you can tell from the quotes at the press conference, she made a lot of sense and didn't, you know, she said, I could have had a go, but, you know, could have thrown it away. And you often see a person who doesn't get an opportunity, often to finish at the front, get circumstances to do it and then throw it away by doing something stupid. And Simone did exactly the right thing and kept her head down and brought the car home. And that's a good result for everybody at HVM.
I still think that if Viso hadn't gotten in her way, she would have actually gotten TK.
She had
a lot more momentum up until that point, and he just completely dragged her down.
Crazy Venezuelans.
Paul?
Mm-hmm.
The reason why Paul is mooing me is because this happens to be the very topic of our Counterpoint article that will be, as of this recording, is not yet posted on IndyCar Nation, but will be shortly. So, Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, I just completely disagree with you. And it comes back to, again, Steph, you and I, we disagree on this whole theory of driver etiquette and, you know, what a lap driver is supposed to do when they're passed by faster cars. Look, EJ didn't do anything wrong in this situation in my mind. TK was close enough to make the move. He made the move easily. Viso gave Simona more than enough room. He was all the way on the left side. He didn't block her. He didn't use the push-the-pass to keep her behind. He didn't you know, force her down to the inside. She had all the room she needed. She simply wasn't close enough to make the pass.
I'm shaking my head while you're talking, my friend.
Well, okay, shake your head till the cows come home. The fact is she didn't have enough momentum and she wasn't close enough to make the pass.
So when she did have her momentum back, even if that is the case, which I don't agree with you, I still think Visa was on a lap all by himself. He should have done everything he could to keep her, to let her by. And if he did do everything that he could, then in turn two, he should have been moving out of the way. He was on his own lap, like six laps down. He had nothing, no stake in that fight, and all he did was break up the best battle going on in the racetrack.
He didn't break it up. Simona overdrove the corner. She broke it up.
She would have been right back up behind him if Vizo hadn't gotten in the way.
So what? Is he supposed to be black flagged just because he's six laps down and somebody's in the vicinity of him? No, she still needs to pass him. He's still on the track. He's still driving. If he's not supposed to drive, take him off the track.
I'm just saying back in the day, he would have been there would have been a blue flag out, and if he didn't heed it, there would have been a black flag. And that's the way I think it should be.
But for what? He didn't
because
do anything. He is not required to.
There's racing going on, and he's not involved in it. He should not be trying to get involved in it.
He wasn't trying. Did you see where he was driving?
He affected it. He got right in the middle of it.
Not by his own volition. He gave her all the room she needed.
And then stayed in front of her for at least half a lap, which he should not have done. Shane, you're the third seat here. Break this up. Where do you side?
So fair. He's a road racing guy.
Yeah, exactly. Look, if the blue flags are being shown, you got to get out of the way. That's the question. I suppose the reality is of it. It's one of those situations. If they weren't teammates, would you look at it differently? I suppose if Kanaan and Vizo weren't teammates, that's the first question I'd ask. The second question I'd pose is in that situation where you're going to penalise someone for doing that. Unless you've got a really clear rule and not a vague rule, it's very hard to do so. And you have a look at the Formula One rule for that situation. If you get a blue flag in three sectors and you ignore it after the third sector, they ping you, and it's very clear. And it's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily lead to fairer racing, but at least the rule is, you know, completely clear and transparent, and everyone knows what the deal is.
I would agree with you absolutely on that. I'm not going to come ahead and say that I think that Vizo should have been penalized this weekend in that exact situation. No, because, as you said, it hasn't been applied consistently. I think it should be applied consistently because I think that this is something that's been going on for too long, and it's really it's egregious. It takes really good lead lap racing and lets people get in the way of it, and it's terrible. Vizo had nobody he was battling with at the time. There was just no reason for him not to back off as soon as he could.
Yeah, I suppose the question is did he have the situational awareness that was happening? I mean, you really don't know unless you were there. I'm of the view that, you know, you got to give him the benefit of the doubt in circumstances where you don't know what the deal is, and this is probably one of those cases.
Can you elaborate on that? I'm trying to understand exactly what you mean.
You don't know where the blue flags were. You don't know whether he was told there was another car behind him, let alone, you know, you don't know if he was told the situation and to sort of try and hold her up or not try and hold her up. It's one of those things where I don't think he did anything bad enough to be slapped on the wrist, in which case I'd probably go fair play, carry on.
Well, Steph's crabby the rest of this podcast.
No, I'm... Shane has actually managed to take a nearly neutral position, and I'm not sure how he did that.
I would say this. Let me just say this to wrap this up. If there was a rule that said that, you know, if he was shown the blue flag, which I don't even think he was, because they showed the overhead shot.
Do they even use the blue flag anymore? I can't remember the last
time
I saw it.
The blue flag, maybe this is just coming from an oval background, the blue flag has never actually meant you are required to pull over.
It's a
cautionary symbol that says, hey, there's somebody faster behind you, be aware. It's not, hey, pull over and let them go by, and then you can, you
because
know, go on your
way. Because you're you're supposed to let the person by.
No,
it's
that's
a
not
professional courtesy.
See, there you go. You want that free pass again. You want something that they didn't earn. It all goes back to this whole thing at Long Beach last year.
Okay. Well, we're gonna agree to disagree, and we're gonna let that article go up on IndyCar Nation, and we're gonna let the IndyCar Nation argue it out and see how things go, because you and I are never going to agree on this.
You come back now, Shane.
Yeah, okay. You finish fighting. I'll send you both to your rooms.
No supper.
We're finished fighting about that.
All right. Well, while we're on the topic of Vizo. This seems like a good segue. Speaking of Vizo and lacking professionalism, if I may be so bold, not only did he not let Simona by when he should have, but he also had a spin early in the race and three wrecks in three practice sessions, the first three practice sessions of the weekend. Now, here's my theory. We don't have Milka and Marias to pick on anymore, so I think Vizo's just next in line. Park Vizo.
Well, he had the three accidents. He also had another spin that brought out yellow.
That's right, he did.
Yeah. It's what we've proven is if you put a larger number on the back of your car, it doesn't give you any more re-downforce. That's for certain. Everyone has a bad weekend every now and then. Let's just wait. But it isn't a good sign.
Vizo's had more than his share of bad weekends.
Everyone has a good weekend now and then.
I'm prepared to give him at least a couple of more races, it's great we have these people, with Vizo, he crashes into everything, but he has some personality, and that's what this sport needs. It needs a driver, we need someone to wear the black cap, and, if Mr. Tracy's not going to be around, then, I think Mr. Vizo does the job quite nicely.
I'll give you that.
To his credit, he rolled all four wheels back on the trailer or on the transporter when it really counted at the end of the race.
Yeah, with his Franken car.
Well, let's just say that's more than four-time champ Sebastian Bourdais can say.
Oh,
and
good
his
segue.
And his who is his actual teammate anyway, Mr. James Jakes.
Yeah, I don't think that Dale Coyne Racing was having a very good morning on Sunday.
Dale Coyne has already made a pretty good showing to follow up nicely to KVRT's season last year. I don't even know how many times Jake's actually ended up spinning, crashing, bringing out yellows or not, but it had to be three or four during practice.
To me, the bigger problem is the Seabass barbecue and... exactly how much money that cost Dale, because I would love to see that contract and whether he actually had to pay out to Bourdais for not actually racing.
Oof. Well, that was Bourdais' second big act, because the one in qualifying was no... trust me, that was not just a white wall either. That was... I have a picture of Sebastian Saavedra's car on the IndyCar website, or on the More Front Wing website, and that car was trashed, and Bourdais wasn't as injured, but it definitely got some good damage before during that qualifying session that I'm sure the crew had to scramble a good chunk of the night to repair it, and then for both of those cars to go out literally on the same lap on complete opposite ends of the facility.
Dale must have really ticked somebody off.
Oh.
Just a nightmare. Yeah, not good. Not good. Shane, any comment about that?
Apart from the fact it's going to be expensive, no. I mean, these things happen in motor racing, and the fact they got James to the grid's probably not a bad effort considering the circumstances.
No, from what I understand, they didn't even have a complete backup car with them. They had to piece together what they could find. I never did actually hear whether they managed to get that one car together with what they had on hand or whether they had to go begging through the paddock. Did you hear, Paul?
I didn't. No, I don't know.
So I know that there was discussion that there was going to be the possibility of them having to go open hand through the paddock, but I don't know if it actually ever happened.
Well, they must have had plenty of spare side pods and several other things, because it had new side pods on it when it came out for the race. This is Jake's car now.
Yeah.
It had all new side pods on it when it came out for the race. It would have had to have a new under tray on it as well. So. They must have had a... I didn't hear of them going begging through the paddocks. I have a feeling they probably had three cars.
I know they didn't have a complete car.
Probably.
I know that for a fact.
They had a DP-01. Maybe maybe they used some hacksaws and, you know, super glue and duct tape and took...
No, I think all the super gluing and duct taping was happening in the Hispania Formula One garage on Thursday and Friday night.
But while we're on this, let's talk about a different issue that Joe Berkmeyer from Trackside and Online and I had quite a discussion about this weekend. Was Bourdais had a hell of a time all weekend. Was he driving that car at 120% just to get all he could out of it? That guy missed turn four more than he ever made it through there. You could just tell he was pushing that hard all weekend. Is that car at a place where even Bourdais, who I have to admit is a great talent on the road and street circuits, is that car too far beyond incapable for him to even show some success in it?
Hmm. Well,
are you suggesting that Milka's been getting more of a hard time than she should be?
No. No.
Yeah, look, I suppose this was always going to be one of the questions and one of the question marks over this combination and you know on the face of it we're naught for one. The challenge is you know when you've got a car that's not up to speed is overdriving, and if you have a look at even you know Will Power's first year at KV Racing, and you know you've seen other examples where you get guys who are you know obviously got the talent to make it work, and then they jump in something like this, and then you know sometimes they make it work, and sometimes they don't. That's just the way it is. The thing that's probably worth noting is that he hasn't had much time in the Dallara either. So, and Will has said that the Dallara on the limit is harder to drive than the Champ car, which is an interesting sort of note.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was very interesting. I wouldn't have expected that, because people are always saying how, you know, the Champ cars had so much more horsepower. You would think that would make them a little bit harder to manhandle. But I mean, the Dallaras on the road courses were not—they weren't designed for that type of driving. So maybe that's just the trick that makes it that much harder to handle them.
I think there's a perception because they're inverted commas, they're large and they're sort of unwieldy, that they might be a bit easier to drive. But I think the reality is they've been in the field for so long, and to get that last, you know, tenth, half a tenth, you've got to wring the absolute neck out of them, which you probably didn't have to do with the Champ cars when they were new, because people were still looking for, you know, two tenths and three tenths. They weren't trying to get the last little tiny bit out of them, you know, and that's where we're at with these cars, and that's you know the symptom of why they're hard to drive has probably got more to do with that than anything else.
That's an excellent point. And the other point that I made, and I think Shane, you started to touch on this, is that what I saw of Bourdais and watching him drive and watching him miss turn four, turn eight, some of the other tight turns down there over and over and over this weekend, wasn't totally dissimilar from what we saw Takuma Sato do at the beginning of last year when they first came from the Formula One car, where, you know, you need to break, you know, like 35 feet before a hairpin turn to get the car to go. And here, these are much heavier cars. They don't brake as well. And last year with Sato and this weekend with Bourdais, we just saw them shoot right through the braking zone, and they don't make it. Is it more of a just a driving style that, you know, he hasn't, like you said, Shane, he's never driven this Dallara. He drove a G-Force back in 2005 at Indianapolis, but you're not standing on the brakes there.
I think that's absolutely it. I mean, you know, if you've ever watched a Formula One car go into a braking zone, I mean, it is seriously, you know, quick. It is noticeably and visibly quicker than an Indy car under brakes. And that's the... Yeah, you know, that's the thing that you just don't get watching on TV. On TV, it looks all the same, but I can assure you, it's absolutely not. And that's the you know, it does take time. I mean, I don't think you know, Briscoe didn't exactly set the world on fire here early on either. So, you know, from Formula One testing. So, you know, I think that's probably got something to do with it. And, you know, Sato's got better, and Sato's not making the mistakes that he was on the road courses earlier in the year last year. And maybe Seabass needs a bit of time as well. I think the expectation with Bourdais is significant, though. That's the big hurdle for him.
Absolutely. But speaking of Sato, that is one thing that I wanted to point out, is that he drove a very quiet race and ended up with a fifth-place finish, which I think if anybody had told you before the race started that's how Sato was going to end up, they would have thought you were crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it was the first thing I posted on my Twitter when I looked at the results. I thought, no one will talk about that. I'm glad you've brought it up, Steph. It's, Sato did exactly the right things and you know, despite his reputation for trouble, didn't seem to find it on Sunday and got the result.
Yeah, no. KV put two cars in the top five. Mm-hmm. I would not have guessed that going into the weekend.
No. No, absolutely not.
Drove a very heavy race. I don't think Sato really put a wheel off all weekend. I think he drove very well this weekend. I forget where he qualified, but I don't recall ever getting a chuckle out of it over the weekend of, hey, look, Sato's already off track. Certainly not like we did Viso.
No. No, he was very quiet and performed well, and good on him. Let's hope he carries on that way.
It would be great to see, you know, great to see not only Kanaan have success there, but see Sato have success and really turn this KV back around to where we thought they were going to be 3 years ago. You know, they were probably the top Champ Car team after the first year of the unification. We thought that KV was going to be really a contending team in 2009 and certainly in 2010, but obviously that hasn't turned out that way. And if you can get Kanaan and Sato to really mature, Kanaan's already mature. If you can get Sato to mature and understand really how to race, particularly on the ovals, boy, that could be a hell of a combination for that team, and they could really make some noise this year, I think.
KV has had little sparks of brilliance. They have the odd race where things go extremely well for them. The 2009 race at Chicagoland comes to mind, where Marias finished, what was it, third?
Third, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They just have these little momentary sparks, and then everything falls apart again. It would be great to really see things kind of gel and come together for them, and I think that TK may be the exact thing that they need to see that happen, because for the last few years they've had quite a bit of inexperience, and the experienced drivers that they've had, thinking of, for example, Paul Tracy, have sort of been come and go. So TK might just be the thing that team needs to really bring it together and get results coming.
You can say what you like about the series being, you know, inverted commas, truly, truly unified. But, you know, true unification will come with this new car, because
Absolutely. Everyone
starts from zero. Everyone starts exactly the same point. And if you have a look at why Champ Car was so competitive in the last year that it had, it was because everyone started from the same point. So you had Forsyth, you had Walker, you had KV, they were all about even. Race wins, even HEM, you know, did all right over there. Everyone was even because they all had new kit, and it was draw the line and start again. And I think the good bit is for KV Racing is they've got a chance, you know, if they put in a multi-year scenario with Kanaan, they've got a good chance to get the chemistry right, get all the, you know, the HR and the process things right in year one. And then in year two, they've got the new car. They're at zero with everyone else. And look, I think the same situation applies with Newman Haas as well. They, you know, next year will be very interesting when all these guys start from the same start line as Penske and Ganassi do.
Yeah, but how long is it going to take before Penske and Ganassi move the line? That's really the bigger question.
But Newman Haas didn't exactly drive into the distance in the first year of Champ Car. And you know, look, the best teams will always eventually come to the fore, but it's very hard to, even if you're the best organised team, if you're starting 3 or 4 years behind the ball game, it's going to be very hard to do well. If KV can get their team structure organised, come into a, you know, a new season with a stable lineup in 2012, they've got all the same opportunities.
I think the thing that they don't have that's the same is the money.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what's going to keep Penske and Ganassi ahead. So the question really is, how long is it going to take in 2012 for Penske and Ganassi to spend that money, do their development, and get things further ahead? And are the smaller teams going to be able to keep up? And are factors like TK bringing some establishment to the organization at KV, are those kinds of things going to be enough to keep things competitive?
Look, it all depends on how the technical regulations shape up, and you know, you can design technical regulations where money makes a supreme amount of difference, and you can design technical regulations where money makes a minimal amount of difference, but in the end, money makes difference. You know, the dollars talk and the dollars get results, but I suppose what I'm trying to say is that, you know, by grabbing Kanaan this year and using this year to get organised, if they can sign him on a multi-year deal, then they give themselves every opportunity to do well in 2012, and that's what they need to do.
Yeah,
okay, that's fair.
I'd argue that.
Okay, so we don't want to touch on Barber too much because we're going to cover that next week, but one thing that we should mention is both of Dreyer and Reinpold's drivers unfortunately sustained wrist injuries at the race in St. Pete this weekend. Justin Wilson, it sounds like, is going to be fitted with a brace, so he should be okay to race at Barber, and I'm pretty sure that he would race anyway. Anna Beatriz, on the other hand, that was a bad pun, sorry. Anna Beatriz went in for surgery today, and we should hear shortly whether she'll be in at Barber. Of course, the rumor mill is already swirling that if she is not in at Barber, will we see PT, which will only remain to be seen with time, but it should make things interesting. Anyway, nothing further to discuss on that for the moment, but Shane, while we have you, we thought we'd ask you a couple of questions. Since with you being in Australia, you have a very different view on things than we have over here. So can we interview you?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Are you asking Shane if he wants to talk?
I still not fastly refuse to answer any more questions. No, of course not.
Okay, well, first of all, tell us how the IndyCar Series is doing in Australia. Do people actually know who Ryan Briscoe is and who Will Power are, and do these things get discussed week in, week out?
Look, realistically, where, you know, the IndyCar Series is not the primary series in Australia. The pecking order is fairly clear. The pecking order is V8 Supercars is the number one motorsport in the country. Mark Webber is a clear second, and then you get to everyone else. Now, Marcus Ambrose is probably next, and the reality is his exposure is nothing to do with NASCAR's strength. It's more to do with the fact that he's an ex-V8 supercar driver.
I was going to say the same thing. Yeah, I was going to ask about that.
And then you've got Will, who's ahead of Briscoe. You know, the fact with, you know, Will obviously with the Team Australia backing, has a little bit more exposure than Ryan, because, you know, Ryan left Australia at 16 to pursue his career. He just about deserves the United Nations flag on his car rather than the Australian car. He spent so much time overseas getting to the top, and that's a reality for any Australian driver who wants to get to that position. In terms of exposure, there's a new TV deal this year here. We've gone from ESPN cable network to Speed. Speed's not the same Speed as the US Speed. It's the same branding, but it's different content. It's a new channel for this year. They've got the rights to the Sprint Cup as well as the IndyCar Series, and that probably helps in terms of exposure, because they're more keen on cross advertising across the platform. The Speed station is affiliated with the Fox Sports stations in Australia, which has the rights to the big ticket Australian sports like Australian rules football and rugby league and the like. So you get some cross promotion opportunities there as well. ESPN's a bit of an island here, because it really only shows the stuff that other people don't want the rights for. So to get off ESPN's a good thing. and speeds hitting the same amount of homes as ESPN used to. So, yeah, there's really no change. I mean, until there's an event here, you know, these guys aren't probably going to get big time exposure. But, you know, the events like the V8 Supercar event on the Gold Coast where they do the guest drive helps a bit. But the reality is here it's all about V8 Supercars and that's pretty much it.
Well, that's interesting that you mentioned surfers because that was going to be my next question for you. That event doesn't get talked about much over here these days, of course, but want to ask you how that event is doing in its new structure, and is there any lamenting of the fact that the IndyCars are no longer heading over for that?
Oh, yeah, in terms of the in the motorsport sector, absolutely there's a lamenting, and I think the tourism numbers are probably down a bit as well. You've got to appreciate they've changed the cost model for the event significantly by not having the IndyCars there. So they've reduced the length of the circuit, so they only use the top half of the circuit now. So that's reduced the cost of setting up the temporary barriers and all that sort of stuff by about half. Running it, you know, V8 Supercars only, they get, I mean, the crowd numbers per day, you're talking sort of, you know, 60,000 and not 90,000.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not getting the international tourists and necessarily drawing the same amount of interstate tourists as you would because, you know, I can see a V8 Supercar event, you know, at the Grand Prix in Melbourne. I can see one at Phillip Island, which is two hours down the road, drive, and I can see another one 2 hours up the road at Winton. You know, there's no real hook to get the interstate travellers in. So it's not as good for tourism and it's not as good for, you know, motorsport fans, but the reality is that they've managed to reduce the cost model to the point where it's viable and it works for them, and that's the way it'll stay.
Do you think there would be interest if IndyCar wanted to come back over, even to any other location other than Surfers? Does Australia want to see American open wheel racing?
Look, I think there's an audience here. It's just a matter of economics. I mean, you've only got 20 million people here, so you know, trying to raise a $10 million fee to bring them across is a lot more difficult to do than it would be to get a $10 million to get to Brazil, for instance, when you can hit so much more of hit so much more people. The most of the events here of major kind that are motorsport events are funded by the state government. So, for example, the Grand Prix that was run here last weekend in Melbourne is funded to the tune of about $50 million by the Victorian taxpayer, and the Queensland race was similarly funded. Most of those states are probably, you know, pretty close to the edge of their budgets. Probably the only exception is Western Australia, which is probably looking for another marquee event, given it lost the Red Bull Air Race, which was its sort of marquee event that it had until 2 years ago. But there's been, you know, not that much movement on that front. Adelaide are probably pretty happy with their V8 Supercar race. Melbourne are happy with their Grand Prix. Sydney, you've got a V8 Supercar race that they're, I wouldn't say they're very happy with because they've just had a change of state government, and the V8 Supercar race is probably not a contributing factor, but the fact that money was spent a bit indiscriminately was. Really, there's not much room to fund it. You know, you're not going to get a private investor because these events don't make profit.
All right. Well, not the answer that we were hoping for, unfortunately, but yeah, that's fair. You spent the weekend at Albert Park.
I did.
Compare that experience, without getting too far off topic, you know, always with an eye to how it compares to American Open Wheel. Your last Surfers event, you were there at 2008, right?
Yep.
And you were over at Indianapolis in 2009. Yep, I know far too much about your travel experience.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
That almost qualifies you as a stalker, but anyway.
Yeah, apparently. Yeah. So compare your F1 experience at Albert Park to those sorts of events.
Look, it's probably not it's almost not directly comparable because it's almost a different kind of event. The difference between American events and Australian events is they do like to pack the schedule in. There's a large amount of support categories, and I know IndyCar sort of heading that way, but even on the street circuit races in America, you know, there's always something to do and you need to make an event and an attraction that people want to go to. where all, the motor racing is almost a side point for a lot of people, you know. A lot of people go and don't see a race car for the whole weekend, you know. At Albert Park, for example, there was a concert post-race. There was also a dance music festival, you know, in one of the places inside the venue for those into that kind of thing. You know, it's a different, you know, very different atmosphere to an IndyCar event where, you know, certainly all the ones I went to where it was about the racing.
How many different events were there in conjunction with the Adelaide F1 race?
Oh, with the Melbourne race?
Melbourne, I'm sorry, not Adelaide, Melbourne.
On the support program, you had VET Supercars. They had a celebrity challenge race. They had a Formula 5000 historic race. They had Carrera Cup. And they also had, like, you know, speed comparisons and lots of other sort. That was just on track, and then off track you've got, you know, as well as your standard stalls and rides and all that sort of stuff that you tend to have at these events. You know, you had that the dance party and they often have like jugglers and clowns and stuff wandering around the venue. So, you know, it's one of those things. It's more of a festival, you know, feel than an IndyCar event. And I think a lot of the American events on the street circuits are heading that way anyway.
Here's a question for you. Just popped into my head. Didn't even plan this one. You're the only person I know who's seen the movable wing in action. What did you think?
Look, I suppose when you look at it's great to it was great, and then it created interest. And I suppose that's always a good thing. The effectiveness, you know, it probably didn't work as effectively as what everyone was hoping for. The objective was to make it, you know, induce passing and make it possibly, you know, easier to pass. But the reality is it probably only created one or two additional opportunities, and those opportunities weren't converted. Now, the question is that because of the technical issue with the wing, or is it because of the fact that, you know, there isn't many opportunities at Albert Park anyway, and it's very hard to give the right amount of time to make the wing work? And I think we'll find out more about that in Malaysia with the longer straights and the bigger opportunities. But so the jury's probably still out on the wings. I mean, the tyres worked. You know, Pirelli did a good job with the tyres and made that work. The KERS system is back in Formula One this year, and that it was interesting to notice how the cars behaved in the braking area, which is the point that the KERS energy is gathered. How different they sound and how different those systems work in each car. It was worth noting that Red Bull decided not to run it for the race. So they were obviously pretty comfortable with how far they were ahead of the field. They didn't feel the need to take a risk running KERS in Australia. I think that might change for Malaysia.
Going back to the wing, my perception is that technology would be impractical for IndyCar. Would you agree with that? Now, I mean, you're much more well-versed in F1 technology than I am, so I defer to your judgment on this.
Look, with the current cars, I'd say yes. With the 2012 car, look, it's not out of the realms of possibility. The interesting sort of note that I noted on this is Tony Coppen was talking about a standard electronic control unit, a standard ECU in these cars, and the supplier he was talking was McLaren, mm-hmm. and McLaren are the control ECU supplier for Formula One, and the rear wing movement goes through the control ECU. So, you know, practically there's no technical limitation in theory on why the 2012 cars couldn't have this if they wanted it.
Okay, now this is a total rookie question because this is beyond my technical knowledge completely. Do they have to change out the ECU when they go to an oval kit? I wouldn't think they would right now, but would they need to if they needed to use if they went to the movable wing?
You just reprogram it.
Okay.
If you even needed to do that, it'd be just different software, not hardware. So I don't see that as a big drama at all.
Okay. Interesting. We may very well see that then. I thought it added a very interesting element of driver skill as well. in terms of knowing when to hit the button to bring the wing down. And I wonder, I didn't get to have a very close look at F1 in Australia this weekend just because of the time zones, and having a 3-month-old makes it difficult to do very much time shifting. But
you have no time zone, Steph. You've got a 3-month-old.
Exactly.
You're in my time zone.
Right. But my perception was that it would add a really interesting element of driver skill to know when to hit the button, to not miss your marks on the button, as well as everything else that you have to think about at various points in the lap. Did it actually play out that way?
No, not really. I mean, the rule is you've got to be how it works is the ECU doesn't enable the functionality unless you're within 1 second of the car in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can only use it in a prescribed part of the track. So, for example, at Albert Park, there was, I think it was 830 metres between the, halfway between turn 15 and 16 and the first turn. So it was halfway between the last turn and the first turn where you could use it. So, yeah, there's no real skill in using it per se, but...
That's a shame, because there's a lot of potential there. Why was it decided to limit it so much?
I think there were concerns about safety with movable wings and Formula One are probably, obviously movable wings were in Formula One cars in the 60s at various points and it led to accidents. So I suppose
right, but that was so long ago and safety's come so far since then.
I think it was right to be conservative with the implementation first go, and I think also, it did come in with a specific objective, and that was to help passing. It wasn't just to make speeds higher for the sake of making speeds higher. So they enabled it outside what they perceived to be the best passing opportunity, and the general view of the sort of the people at the track is maybe they didn't pick the right spot, because the final turn at Albert Park is a slow speed corner and there's a lot of acceleration. And it allowed the car in front to just get that little bit too far away for the wing to have a big effect.
Mm-hmm.
Malaysia, you've got some longer straights and you've got some different corners before those longer straights. I think in those races we'll see the true potential of that equipment.
Okay, well, that'll be interesting to look forward to for sure. Paul, anything else to add before we sign off?
I was going
to
say, don't you think we have enough problems getting through the first turn on double restarts than to be worrying about whether we have movable wings or not?
It's another interesting aspect of technology, that's all.
It is worth noting you can't use the movable rear wing in Formula One on the first two laps of the race and the first two laps after a restart.
This is so complicated.
It is very complicated.
Have you ever read the Formula One technical regulations? They are awesome. They are the most. They actually define what color the carpet should be on the podium in the appendices.
Really?
Yep. Now, I mean, they're very precise and they're very but it's good. It's open and you can have a read of it. It's a great read. It's if you're technically minded, it's actually good. They've got stuff like the onboard cameras go here, here, and here, and exact specifications of those onboard cameras. And, if you're a bit of a technical nerd, it's something I recommend you go and visit the FIA website and go and have a bit of a read.
Hmm.
And you can read all the rules, too. They're open to everybody, which is a great idea.
And they're written in pen, right?
They are. In fact, what they do, which is really intelligent, every year when they upload them, they leave track changes on so you can actually see what's changed.
Really?
Which is actually really good. So mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of those. It's one of the first things we do every year down here before the, because we're one of the first races usually, is get out the Formula One technical regulations and go, yeah, don't like that one, like that one. Mm. Just mark it off on our list.
Hmm.
Yeah. Something for IndyCar to look at. I believe there is a movement in IndyCar to make the rules more transparent than they have been. There's on the media site at IndyCar.com right now. There's actually a link that hasn't been made yet that says to view the 2011 rulebook, click here. So I've been watching that carefully to see if it actually shows up.
I have to say, as a really interested fan, and I'm probably a little more interested than the average fan, I'd love to see a copy of them.
Shane, do you have anything you want to add to the conversation before we sign off?
No, I probably actually should get back to work. On a quiet Wednesday afternoon in Melbourne, I have to get paid, so I better get back to what I'm paid to do.
Paul, anything to add?
I think that'll wrap it up. I guess I just want to say thanks to all the followers and listeners that followed along this weekend as we kicked off our 2011 coverage from St. Pete, and we certainly look forward to bringing more coverage throughout the year. At this point, our next one won't be until Indianapolis, but you never know. Maybe one of us will win one of those $350 million mega million lotteries that we have down here.
Yeah, they don't have those in Canada. Yeah. But I don't need $350 million. $30 million will do.
Yeah. Are you saying you're going to be the next person in to meet the corporates after Paul Tracy? Looking for a sponsor?
Yeah, I think I better hit the pavement. Absolutely. Shane, thanks for joining us. It's always a pleasure.
A pleasure talking to you guys. Thank you.
It's been a treat, Shane. Good to talk to you again.
Absolutely. And we'll be back next week to do a preview of the race at Barber Motorsports Park in Alabama. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. And remember that morefrontwing.com is your source online for blogs, photos, podcasts, and more covering the IZOD IndyCar Series and beyond.